So nice to have you on the podcast.
Thank you very much for having me.
My pleasure. And let's get started with what's going on right now between Hezbollah and Israel.
My pleasure.
What do you understand from the behavior of Israelis right now? They're trying to attack with this offensive in the southern part of Lebanon. What is the general understanding of Lebanese right now?
Well, just for some background, I came on the second day when the onslaught began, when they began bombing the south and central Lebanon, killing, I think, 500 people on the first day, almost exclusively civilians. And when I was in Beirut, I was sitting with a friend in a hotel cafe, and we were discussing the situation. And then we heard these massive explosions, which later I was told there were 83 missiles, each roughly 1,000 kilos. And the girls started screaming and the women started screaming and everyone was confused. We thought that, and the bombs were one after the another, like within not a second apart, much less than that. They just came one after the other. And it was like next door. And we went outside and we saw roughly 1,000 meters away the smoke and the fires. And I knew where this was because I lived very near there for a year during my sabbatical, when I was working, when I was on my sabbatical at AUB and also working with Conflicts Forum in 2011 and 12. So I would often go to that neighborhood or drive through it. Those six apartment towers, they're full of people, women, children, hundreds of people just disappeared immediately, wiped out. And husband and wife, I didn't know were living there, but a husband and wife, a young family who were friends of my son, because during that year we were in Beirut, my son went to school in southern Beirut, and his classmate happened to be in Iran, was a close friend, and he came to Iran for his wedding with his wife. Apparently, we're almost certain that they were killed and they were murdered in that strike. So that family was just completely wiped out. I'm giving this background so people can get an understanding of what the Israeli regime is doing and how the West and Western media is trying to frame this as these are Hezbollah strongholds and targets. No, after bombing and murdering Sayed Hassan and killing all hundreds of people, a few hours later, they started striking across southern Beirut. They gave three targets and a very short period of time for people to go, and maybe a lot of them never knew of the warnings. But they didn't strike three targets. They struck, I think, 12 targets. And they were just buildings. They were residential buildings. Anyone who's lived in southern Beirut knows that these are just residential buildings. But again, the BBC, the CNN, New York Times, Fox News, Sky News, The Guardian, The Washington Post, they all say, you know, Hezbollah targets, or this is a Hezbollah stronghold. It's like on 9/11 saying New York is a regime stronghold, or in London when they bombed it on, as they say, that they used to say back then, 7/7, that this is a regime, you know, the underground in London, this regime stronghold. And to use, I mean, most of the targets were just buildings, but even when murdering and during the martyrdom of Sayed Hassan Nasrallah, when they bombed and killed hundreds of people, when they say that, well, they are embedded in the civilian population, that is another justification. That, first of all, that doesn't make it legal. It's completely illegal. And those countries that gave these bunker busters are criminal and terrorists like the Israeli regime. But in everywhere in the world, in the capitals, they have their Ministry of Defense, they have their intelligence agencies, they have their Hezbollah as a part of civil society, their political party, the government, they're a part of the coalition. Their coalition won the last election in Lebanon. Their armed forces is accepted by the state. And they made Sayyid Hassan Nasrallah's, the place where he was staying was deep underground so that the Israelis would not bomb civilian targets. It would be so down, far down below that they would not kill people. But what they did instead with American help and Western help is kill more people so that they can get at him. So this is what we're experiencing here in Lebanon today. And I've been talking to the Western media the last 2-3 days. One of the things is when I speak to people privately, they're saying one thing, but when they're in front of the camera, they're saying something very different. It's stunning.
Yeah. And right now, with the situation that we're having between Hezbollah and Israel, many people are asking, yesterday I was talking with many experts, that they were asking why Hezbollah is hesitating to respond to Israelis. And what do we know from Hezbollah right now? Are they going to respond? To what extent they're going to respond?
I think right now we're beginning to see the response to that question, and that Hezbollah is now being much more assertive in retaliating. My understanding is that the resistance has always wanted the Israeli regime to escalate first so that the international community, forget the West, they're not the international community, so that the international community knows exactly where things stand. And now everyone is seeing that the Israeli regime is carrying out genocidal airstrikes. We have to remember that the West no longer has a monopoly over information. Your own YouTube channel is evidence of that. So the world has changed, and people living in different countries have their own local sources for information as well. So the world is seeing what the Israelis are doing. CNN can spin it, and the BBC can spin it in whatever way they want. And they will have their own supporters. Empire has always had many supporters. That's how empires thrive. But Hezbollah and the resistance and Iran and the axis of resistance wants to make sure that the global community is on their side. And I think this, from what we're seeing across the world, that's become very clear that they've achieved that. But now that the Israeli regime is trying to enter Lebanon, we're seeing that Hezbollah is showing its capabilities. And as I've been saying for a very long time, Iran will not allow Hezbollah to be defeated. Iran will not allow the resistance in Gaza to be defeated. Not only has Iran been supporting all of these resistance organizations, whether in Gaza or the West Bank, or in Lebanon, in Yemen, and Syria and Iraq in the past, but it's doing so as we speak. It's funneling in supplies to Gaza. It's giving them the capability to build new tunnels, have new weapons, new capabilities. And that's why after a year, the Israeli regime has failed to capture this dot on the map. It's the resilience of the resistance, whether among the Hamas resistance fighters or the Islamic Jihad resistance fighters or the others and the people who have remained steadfast, but also it's been the capabilities that Iran has given to them as what I consider to be Iran's moral responsibility and duty. So Iran is doing this, but I also am very confident that Iran will, when the moment comes, punish the Israeli regime for the crimes that it has carried out. And Iran's excuse will be the martyrdom of Ismail Haniyeh, the martyrdom of a number of senior officers in Lebanon during the past few weeks, or at least a couple that I know of, and the injury of Iran's ambassador in Lebanon. I'm confident about that. Some people have become very skeptical, but what I find very interesting is while a lot of people are attacking me and saying that this is all talk and you're doing propaganda, what is very interesting to me is that people across the world want Iran to hit Israel. And people who are in contact with me from Latin America, Africa, Europe, North America, Asia, they're saying, why doesn't Iran do something? And this, I think, shows how the world has changed and how the resistance has become so iconic and how the axis of resistance in the eyes of the international community has changed. It used to be the demonic evil force, led by Iran, axis of evil, and that sort of language. And now people are saying, what are you going to do to stop this Holocaust in Gaza, or genocidal airstrikes in Lebanon? But I am confident that Iran will punish the Israeli regime. This Friday, as you've probably just heard, because it's only been 30, 40 minutes, I think, or a bit more, less than an hour, though, it's been announced that Ayatollah Khamenei will be leading Friday prayers this week. And I think that will be a very important speech that he makes.
And with the assassination of Ismail Haniyeh in Iran, and right now with Seyed Hassan Nasrallah in Lebanon, there are two concepts. One of them is that what is the main objective of these assassinations? Because if we remember Seyed Hassan Nasrallah in 1992, when he became the leader of Hezbollah, he had 23 years old. And the contribution to the expansion of Hezbollah, it's enormous. And we know how important he was for Hezbollah. But at the same time, we know that Hezbollah is a huge organization. It's not something that they can destroy by killing 3, 4, 10 people. And how do you see the future of Hezbollah from now on?
First, I think I have to go back to the notion, the idea, and the tradition of Orientalism. When the West thinks that when they say that Hezbollah has been severely weakened because of the martyrdom of Seyed Hassan, when they say Hezbollah or Hamas or anyone else has been severely weakened because of the martyrdom of a senior official, let alone the most towering of all the resistance figures, Seyed Hassan Nasrallah, I think there's a lot of racism in that, and that they think that in their societies, everything is based upon checks and balances, and it is, their society is founded upon much more than individuals and their structures, and it's sophisticated, and they're a sophisticated society. But I think that we are following charismatic people who, if they disappear, then suddenly everything falls apart. Which, if you go back to Orientalist tradition, this has always been a very strong element within, alongside other elements of Orientalism. I actually think the opposite. You're absolutely correct. Seyed Hassan Nasrallah has had an enormous role in this region. He led the defeat of Israel in Lebanon. We have to always remember that in 1982, before Hezbollah was created, as you know, the Israeli regime occupied the very place that I'm sitting right now, in Beirut. And Hezbollah was created in 1982 as a small organization which gradually grew, and it expelled the Israeli regime in the year 2000 under Seyed Hassan's leadership, making him a household name. But also, he helped defeat ISIS and al-Qaeda in Syria. When the West began its dirty war in Syria, we recall how Julian Assange and WikiLeaks, they revealed an email from Jake Sullivan, February the 12th, 2012, the current national security advisor of the president, to Hillary Clinton, who was the Secretary of State, saying that Al-Qaeda in Syria is on our side. This was the beginning of the whole issue. And that's what Iran and Hezbollah were saying back then, because their intelligence agencies recognized what was happening in Syria. But the Arabic media that's owned by a bunch of oil-rich despots and the Western media, they were all creating a narrative of that was very different from reality. And then later on, we had the leaked audio of Kerry where he said we allowed ISIS to advance on Damascus. And I think Obama, in an interview with The Atlantic, if I'm not mistaken, your viewers should correct me if I'm wrong, he said that we allowed ISIS to advance on Baghdad to put pressure on the prime minister, who we had Maliki back then. And then, of course, there's a lot more evidence of the role that the West played, the 2012 Defense Intelligence Agency document, which said regional countries are trying to create a Salafist entity between Syria and Iraq. And then General Michael Flynn, who had led the agency at that time, later said on Al Jazeera that the U.S. supported that. So Syed Hassan Nasrallah helped prevent black flags from being raised in Damascus and Baghdad. He helped Yemen against the Western-backed genocide there as well. And now you see that all of these entities are coming into, are part of the support base for Gaza and the West Bank. What the Americans wanted in Syria was to, when NATO and those regional regimes that did a deal with the devil, what they wanted to do in Syria was to break Syria and to control Syria so that the link between the resistance and Iran would be broken. Because especially after Iraq, they invaded Iraq, things did not go as planned and Iraq became friendly to Iran. They wanted to destroy that bridge. And it's not just Lebanon, it's also, as I said, the West Bank. So Sayyid Hassan Nasrallah played an enormous role in helping Gaza to defend itself, because Yemen put pressure on the Israeli regime from the south, from the Red Sea. What they said, they said they were implementing the Genocide Convention. And they defeated the Americans, who tried to open the Red Sea to the Israelis. And what happened was that it was then closed to the Americans and their allies. Hezbollah put pressure on the north. And then, of course, the West Bank was activated. Resistance in Iraq was activated. But while he is a towering figure, he is not Hezbollah. Hezbollah is a huge organization with very many highly educated people, highly dedicated men and women, highly competent commanders and officers and soldiers who know what they're doing and who are very deeply committed. They believe that this apartheid and genocidal Zionist regime is a threat to, it wants to destroy the Palestinian people. And therefore, they have a moral responsibility to struggle against it. But also, they know that if the Israeli regime succeeds with the Palestinian people, it's an expansionist regime. It's a colony. It will move on to their next victim. So Sayyid Hassan Nasrallah was a towering figure. But I actually believe that he has helped create a powerful organization with powerful allies that is very popular across the region. And over the last year has become much more popular than before. And in a way, I'm sure Iran, some will say these are empty words. I believe that his martyrdom has strengthened Hezbollah, because his martyrdom has made him an icon for everyone. Look at the statements made by Hamas, the statement of Hamas for his martyrdom. He's made everyone into a movement. And he has, and all of those past divisions that the West and these regional despots tried to create religious, sectarian, racial. These have been swept away. There will always be these people who want to work on the sectarian, religious, or ethnic or racial divide, but this is an extraordinary moment. And while for a couple of days people were in fear and many were upset, but Hezbollah quickly regrouped. And today we're beginning to see Hezbollah showing assertiveness on the battlefield and hammering the Israeli regime and firing missiles into Israel in a way in which is different from before. And I think this was, of course, always a part of the calculation. They were waiting for the Israeli regime to come in. So while his martyrdom was very painful, people were weeping on the streets, people who had lost their homes, they didn't care about their homes. Nima, they didn't care about what was happening to their neighborhood or their homes. They were crying for him. But these very same people, they are extraordinarily steadfast. And I think that the Israeli regime, because of this Orientalism that I was alluding to earlier, and the Americans and the Europeans, because of this tradition of Orientalism, this memoir, this reservoir of not Orientalist knowledge, they have miscalculated. And I have no doubt that they will lose this war.
Question right now would be how Iran is seeing the way that Iran is witnessing the situation. And because we know whenever we talk about the conflict in Ukraine, we know how Ukraine is desperate to bring the United States into the conflict in order to make a bigger fight. And the same thing is happening in the Middle East with Israel. They're trying to do everything to bring the United States into a direct conflict between Iran and the United States, because they know at the end of the day they're not capable of fighting Iran. And how do you see the management on the part of the Iranian government in order to bring the tensions, not in order to not let the government, the Netanyahu administration, doing this?
That's a very important point that you're making. And this is something that I think many people who are very upset with Iran right now, and I understand why they're upset, and some people attack me, and when we speak, they're angry. And I understand, although, as I said, I believe Iran will support Hezbollah and Hamas and the resistance and all the Palestinians and the Lebanese by any means necessary, as the late Malcolm X once said. I have no doubt about that. But this is a very important point that you make, and Israel is not Ukraine. The influence that Israel has in among Western elites is far greater than Ukraine. Even though the war in Ukraine is in reality much more important than supporting this small genocidal regime for the West. In fact, supporting this genocidal regime has destroyed the image of the West across the world. They no longer can pretend that they are supporters of human rights or civil society or anything like that, or that their civilization is superior. They're behaving worse than any other part of the world, and they're doing it in front of a global audience. So it's very destructive for the West, but Ukraine is much more important for them if you take ideology and Zionism and put it aside. But the influence of the Zionist regime and Zionism, and of course, Zionism, there's Christian Zionists, there are Jewish Zionists, and there are secular Zionists, so this is not a Jewish issue. And as you know quite well, many Jews are opposed to the Israeli regime. They're at the forefront of the resistance. Many Christians are at the forefront of the resistance, like many Muslims and other people from other religions and other walks of life. But anyway, the ideological influence of this regime and the lobby exists in the United States and makes it extraordinarily influential. So Netanyahu, because he's lost the war, he needs to expand the war. He's lost in Gaza. He's lost with Hezbollah over the last year. He's lost in the Red Sea. He's despised across the world. The economy is in ruins. No one is ever going to invest in Israel again. The military is tired. But most importantly, as I alluded to earlier, Israel alongside the West, its image has been destroyed. People across the world see it as a horrific, immoral regime. This is something that wasn't the case a year ago, except for people like myself and some people from the region, many people from the region, most people from the region, and some people elsewhere. No ordinary people across the world were not really concerned with what was going on here, and they just, Israel was a country like any other, probably, for many. But now that's not the case. I've been to China, I think, 3 times since last year, Russia a couple of times. I've been here and there. The regime is despised. So they need to, and Netanyahu, as we all know, needs to stay in power. His right-wing fanatical allies want the war to continue for their own reasons. So he has to continue the war. But since it's failing, he has to find another way, and that is to expand the war. And by expanding the war, he's not going to win. He couldn't win in Gaza. How is he going to win in Lebanon? He's massacred day and night, but he didn't win. And it's a, as I said earlier, Gaza is a dot on the map, and he couldn't take it after a year. Lebanon is a completely different story. So what is he trying to do? He's trying to get the Americans involved. The region, no one in the region wants a war, because a war would be catastrophic for the global economy, would be catastrophic for everyone, it would be catastrophic for people where you are, where I am, in Iran meaning, and everywhere else. So Iran doesn't want a war. Hezbollah doesn't want a regional war. No one wants one. Netanyahu does. So if we're going to have a regional war, if we are ultimately going to have a regional war, Iran and Hezbollah and the resistance have to make sure that the global South and many in the West see that this regional war is because of the United States and Israel and not because of the resistance. Because even though the Western media and their media apparatuses, as I said, diminished compared to the past, but they still have a powerful media apparatus. And they are very good at turning the tables and changing the narrative and distraction and moving the, you know, we had a genocide for a year in Gaza, a Holocaust, and then suddenly they're celebrating Israel's slaughter of hundreds of people and the march of them of Sayyid Hassan Nasrallah. Suddenly they changed the story completely. You know, the people who were slaughtered, you know, they're not really discussed, and the whole 12 months of slaughter out of the frame. They're very good at that. So Iran wants to make sure that it is not seen as an irrational actor, because Iran wants to keep China on board, it wants to keep Russia on board, it wants to keep Brazil on board, it wants to keep South Africa on board, it wants to keep neighbors on board, Central Asia on board, the global South, Muslim countries, friendly countries, Serbia, Belarus, all these countries. For Iran, it's important that they see what the Israelis are doing before Iran responds. It sees what the Americans are doing before when Iran responds. So there's no simple solution. But ultimately, this war may expand. Because as I said, Hezbollah will show its power, and Iran will punish the Israeli regime. And then the Americans will have to make a decision. But if they do make the wrong decision, their bases in Iraq will be swept away. All of their interests, their embassy would probably be swept away. Their bases in the Persian Gulf region will be swept away. But more importantly, those regimes that host American soldiers or American assets, all of their oil and gas assets are fair game, because they'll be seen as Iran's enemy, hosting Iran's enemy. And that would be catastrophic. That is like 1,000, I don't know, hundreds of nuclear weapons in itself. Imagine what would happen to the global economy if we had such a situation. No one wants this. And by the way, the West itself would see, if the global economy collapses, you will see an influx of refugees into the West like you've never seen before. Because they will still continue down, even though the West will collapse, but you will still see that traditional, the tradition of people who are in impoverished areas moving to the West in hope of some sort of relief from their situation. So this is something that we're all trying to escape. But as I said, Iran will protect the resistance, the people of Lebanon, the people of Palestine, the resistance in the West Bank and Gaza, and Hezbollah by any means necessary. And it's not just Iran now. It is an axis of resistance, and it's not just an axis of resistance. As I was saying earlier, there is a huge support base of resistance that goes across the world, across religious boundaries, racial boundaries. It's truly amazing how things have changed. So hopefully we won't have a regional war, but the Americans have to recognize that Iran will not allow their Zionist allies to gain the upper hand anywhere.
So far, what we've seen from the Biden administration was unconditional support for Netanyahu and his administration. Whatever they're trying to do, they just decide to attack Lebanon, attack Syria, Iraq, Yemen. They do this, and nobody seems to care in the United States. In the Biden administration is the worst government in terms of what's going on with Netanyahu and his administration. But how do we see the European Union's role right now? And what do they do in terms of the genocide in Gaza and what's going on right now in the Middle East?
The European Union is increasingly weak and dependent on the United States. And even though public opinion in Europe is very unhappy, if not very angry, that really is not going to change anything. The same is true in the United States. I was witness to this during the nuclear negotiations, and that both because I was a media advisor, I was not a part of the team. I never go into government. I never plan to be in government. But in 2015, I was a media advisor to the nuclear team led by Dr. Zarif. And 2-3 years ago, I was a media advisor to Dr. Balgani's nuclear team. And it's quite clear that the decision maker is the United States. It has always been the United States. And you've been covering Ukraine extensively, and you have very prominent guests who are very knowledgeable and informed. In Ukraine, the biggest loser after Ukraine itself is the European Union. The European Union is going downhill very fast. Europe is entering an age, an era of darkness. I don't think that the European Union will even last if this continues much longer. So despite all that, the European Union will not break away from the United States, at least under these circumstances, under as long as the current political establishment in Europe is in power. They are, I don't want to say completely irrelevant, but they are almost irrelevant. I don't want to say, you know, they're non-existent, but they're almost non-existent when it comes to the major decisions that are made in the West. The decisions are made in the White House, and it doesn't matter who gets elected in what country in Europe. At the end of the day, they're the foot soldiers. Doesn't matter which party is in power. And it doesn't matter which party is in power in the United States either. Whether it's the Christian Zionist right, they believe in, their cult believes in ethno-supremacism, and they believe that to bring Christ, genocide should happen. To me, it sounds the exact opposite of what Moses or or Jesus would want, obviously. And then the liberal left, with their woke culture and their fluid genders and their 101 different genders, they support this racially supremacist or ethnically supremacist regime just as much as the Zionist, Christian Zionist right. It doesn't make really any difference at all. So whether it's Biden or Harris or Trump, there's no difference in the United States. And whether some A or B is voted in some European country, the decisions are made in Washington. It's quite extraordinary how the empire works, but the image that it has been giving over the years about democracy and checks and balances and the role that the public plays, it's very different from reality.
And it's so interesting that with the new president of Iran, Pezeshkian, and in his inauguration, they assassinated Ismail Haniyeh. And when he was in New York talking with Washington, they assassinated Seyed Hassan Nasrallah. How do you see, is there any sort of meaning behind this administration and the way that Israelis are behaving right now?
You know, that's a very important point. This is a very important point that is rarely discussed. They intentionally assassinate Ismail Haniyeh hours after the president's inaugural speech and after they've hugged and after the president spoke about Palestine. And then while the president, as you know, they ask the Americans through messages during the negotiations for the ceasefire between Hamas, the resistance, and the Israeli regime, they ask Iran to hold back so that they could get a ceasefire. We all knew that there wouldn't be a ceasefire, or at least many of us knew. But the Iranians and Hezbollah, because Seyed Hassan Nasrallah alluded to this in one of his last speeches, that we delayed our response because we didn't want to give, and the Iranians didn't want to give the Americans and the Israelis an excuse to break away from the talks and say, we were almost there, but these Iranians or Hezbollah, they attacked and they ruined the negotiations. They don't want peace. They want the Palestinians to die and be sacrificed and that sort of thing. So the Iranians held back, Hezbollah held back, and nothing happened. And again, the Americans lied, just like when they lied after they negotiated the nuclear deal with Iran. They never implemented it under Obama. I think what it does, it just shows that the West is not serious about engagement at all. There is no, President Pezeshkian, hypothetically, was an opportunity. A new president, a new page. You could say to yourself, well, maybe we can start from scratch or we can begin something new at some level with this person. Any president, any new president, he's supposedly a reformist, although he's not like Khatami or Rouhani. I think he's actually closer to Raisi. When you look at his foreign policy statement in Tehran Times that came out a few months ago, I think they're quite close, in fact. But still, reformist, someone who you could talk to, but they didn't. That's not the objective. The objective is not to look for solutions. Israeli supremacism must be maintained. And we always have to remember, the Lebanon, the country that I'm in right now, the West will never allow it to have a surface-to-air defense capability. It will never allow it to have an air force. It will never allow it to have any defense capability that's meaningful. Because Israel must rule this region, it must be the supreme power. And of course, if that happens, then whenever it wants to expand further, it will. So the West is not serious about engagement, and it will support the Israeli regime to the hilt. to the last Palestinian, to the last Lebanese citizen. Because we're all Amalek. That's the fact of this whole issue. We're all inferior in their eyes. And going back to that Orientalism that I was speaking to earlier, all of this, you know, when you look at it within this context, this is an extension of colonialism that we've seen in over the last few hundreds of years. But the biggest mistake that the West is making, the collective West, Western media, Western elites, Western politicians, Western diplomats, is that this genocide is different. It is unique. It is probably the worst crime in human history. Or at least in the last few hundred years. Not because of the numbers. There have been greater horrors, Second World War, 20 million Chinese that were slaughtered by the Japanese, tens of millions of Slavs that were murdered by Hitler, the Jews and Gypsies, and of course the empire, the Western Empire in Latin America, in Africa, the complete destruction of Africa and the plundering of Africa, which continues today. There have been greater crimes, but this is unique and worse in one specific way, and that is being carried out in front of a live audience and a global audience. So they're doing this in front of our eyes, which is extraordinary, but it has a special effect. It's not just ugly, and it doesn't just destroy the West and its image and the image of the Israeli regime. But I said this before a couple of times, what it does is that it reminds people across the global South of their own history. They're seeing their history in front of their eyes. People read about what happened to Algerians, what happened to our country in the past, their history books and their school books, people in India, people in Zimbabwe and Southern Africa, in Bolivia and elsewhere. You read a few pages in the history book, your teacher says something, you hear about it, maybe a couple of documentaries, your parents may say something. Suddenly all of that is revived because this is the same people, the same Europeans that did this to us, they're doing it now. This is how it looks. This is how it looks. When Christopher Columbus so-called discovered America and his people were slaughtering the natives, this is how it looked. When the conquistadors were taking Latin America, when the colonizers were, crushing the Native Americans or the Indians, as it used to be called, that's how it looked. India and elsewhere. I think the West underestimates the impact this is having on the West, on the rest of the world.
Yeah. And right now there is because Lloyd Austin Lebanese media reported that Lloyd Austin is aware of what's going on in the southern part of Lebanon, and they just gave the green light to Israelis to go with this offensive. And in your opinion, the way that they're trying to avoid, we know that on the part of the United States, they're not willing to have a conflict, direct conflict with Iranians as well, as Iranian doesn't want that. And how about this policy of letting them in? And we know, as you've mentioned, Iran doesn't let Hezbollah to be defeated. And what would be the limit on their part? What do they think about this offensive? Because they're talking about a limited offensive in the southern part of Lebanon. But as Larry Johnson yesterday pointed out, he said that you cannot say a little bit pregnant. You're pregnant or not pregnant?
Absolutely.
What would be that limit for the United States, in your opinion?
Well, the United States has given the Israeli regime a green light from the beginning. For a whole year, they've had nothing but a green light. What is, when they say we gave a green light, when was it red? When was it yellow for them to give them a green light? And taking over territory I mean, it's not just Lebanon. As you know, over the last few years, the land grab in the West Bank has been growing faster and faster. They are taking territory across the board. And Hezbollah knows that once they take the West Bank, they're going to be looking for more territory. These are Zionists. They believe that they are the chosen people, that they are superior. They are a master race of sorts. Not of sorts, that they are. They believe that Lebanon belongs to them, just like they believe Jordan belongs to them. This will not stop. So, and when, let's say that Israel takes southern Lebanon, and let's say it takes the whole of the West Bank, do you think that, does anyone think that the Americans are going to say, okay, here's the red, from now on you have a red light? No. If the Israelis go into Jordan, the Americans and the Europeans will allow it to happen. And the Western media, their journalists will go in and say, well, you know, these Jordanian terrorists, they did this or they did that. And, you know, it's, it's like how they used to justify apartheid South Africa and how Nelson Mandela was a communist. So many in the West supported the racist regime. And it wasn't just South Africa, it was Southern Africa. But that aside, let's just stick to South Africa. So many in the West were supportive of the supremacist regime. And those who were, knew it was evil, they said, well, Mandela is a communist. And the Soviet Union is a threat. So they justified preserving apartheid because the ANC and other resistance organizations were perceived by them to be more tilting to another superpower. So they'll always find a way to justify what the Israelis do. They'll always. And I was on Piers Morgan less than 24 hours ago, and we had a 20-minute discussion. But what was interesting was that at the end of the conversation, he said that I believe Palestinians should have, I said, you know, Palestinians must be treated as equal. He said, I believe they must be treated as equal human beings. And I said, everywhere. And he said, yes, everywhere. And I should have said that then you are a supporter of the resistance, because that's exactly what the resistance says. That is exactly, you know, as well as I, Iran has Jews. We have synagogues. We have kosher restaurants. Hezbollah has no literature that is anti-Jewish. Chomsky, he's not as good as many of the young Jews today who are completely opposed to the Israeli regime, but he was very critical of the Israeli regime. I think he met Sayyid Hassan Nasrallah. I think he had a private conversation with him. This does not have anything to do with Judaism. What the resistance wants is the end of this racist, this supremacist regime. But this is something that the West can't seem to, they won't accept. The elites in the West won't accept this. So they will always give the Israeli regime a green light. And that is where we may have a serious clash, because Israel itself is not a powerful regime. If the West, and especially the United States, cut off its support, the war would be over immediately. They have to constantly bring in weapons, ammunition, aid, give them political cover, propaganda. The propaganda machine works for them day and night. And they do what the intelligence, all that you have drones flying over the NATO drones flying over the Mediterranean, the Five Eyes, including that nice country, New Zealand. They're all in on this together. The Western Embassy is in Beirut, here in Beirut. They spy for the Israelis. The Western-funded NGOs, many journalists, I'm not saying all, many. You know, that's exactly actually why Hezbollah's weakest link has always been Beirut, because it's very difficult to protect yourself against all these adversaries. But then, and I should stress that you haven't seen the Israelis score any successes outside of Beirut. There are thousands of kilometers of tunnels, underground bases with hundreds, I don't know how many soldiers and equipment, how much equipment, but they're all well protected, and the Israeli regime has scored nothing there. But their successes has been here. Why? Because the West is all in. It's all a green light from A to Z or A to Z. And that is the dangerous point, because if it's going to be a green light forever, then we may reach a point where we have a regional war. And if there is a regional war, then that could be, as I said earlier, that could be the point where the oil and gas in the region no longer exists. The means to export them no longer exist. The regimes that export them no longer exist. And I think that would be catastrophic for the West. But when they give the Israeli regime a permanent green light, that is a danger.
Yeah, when it comes to putting an end to this conflict in the Middle East, many people are arguing that the President of the United States, by a single call, can put an end to this conflict. We're not going to send you, we're going to send you weapons, any sort of aid, and you have to stop these attacks. And we know that Israelis are not capable of the continuation of this conflict the way that it is right now. But on the other side, on the other hand, we have Middle Eastern countries. We have Turkey, which is so important in providing Israel with energy. And 40% of their energy comes from Azerbaijan, goes through Turkey, then to Israel. What's wrong with the policy in the Middle East, considering Iran, Saudi Arabia, Turkey, these Muslim countries, that they cannot figure out how to put pressure on Israel?
Well, you know, it's not just the Muslim countries. It's all the countries, very few countries, except for a few in Latin America, and that's it, basically. None of them have really changed their policy in a meaningful way. Those that didn't have relations with the Israeli regime, of course, are continuing to oppose them, the regime. But there hasn't been much change. And Turkey, or Turkey, as you rightly pronounce it, the new name, which is how we pronounce it in Iran anyway, in Turkey. And I should learn to always say Turkey, but now that that's the official name. Turkey is a very big disappointment. They were prepared to, the President Erdogan was prepared to destroy Syria and support ISIS, Al-Qaeda, Al-Qaeda, and all these, Jaish al-Islam, and all these other horrible groups in association with, in alliance with the United States and oil-rich despots alongside King Abdullah and the Israelis. They were all in on it together. But he's done nothing for Palestine and nothing for Gaza, nothing for Lebanon, nothing for the West Bank. And exports continue. Ships continue to use their ports, not just Turkish ports, Egyptian ports. They go through Jordan. They go through Saudi Arabia. I've heard reports that you've seen the footage where the Israeli planes have gone through Saudi Arabia. Then we have the Emirates. And then, of course, Baku giving subsidized oil to Israel. This is extraordinary. But I think, with the exception of Turkey, all of these countries are dictatorships. And whether it's Azerbaijan, Republic of Azerbaijan, or any of these Arab countries in the region, they are regimes that are client regimes. They are dependent on the United States. Even Saudi Arabia they are very much bound to the West, even though they've made they've improved relations with Russia and China, but they're still, these people, their families go to the West for school. They have palaces there. They have their elites. They have mansions there. They They go to university there. They go to the West for vacation. They are bound to the West in every possible way, almost. And they feel that the West protects them from their people too. But the problem is that these regimes are becoming increasingly vulnerable, because the more outrages there is, the more dangerous it is for them. It's like, I used to be a military diver. It's like the surface of the water looks very calm. Everything seems peaceful. But underneath, there are currents that are very powerful and can just sweep you away. Even if you have the best gear, it could be very dangerous. And that could happen. Remember what happened in Tunisia when some young man burned himself alive in protest for some, you know, the way he was treated, he was on the streets. And then you had uproar across the region, and you had the government of Egypt overthrown effectively. So the West is taking big risks, because this is much more, this is what we have now is much worse than what we had in, back then in Tunisia and across the Arab world back then. Turkey is a bit different. I think it's best to have a guest who's more well acquainted with the politics of Turkey. But I think many people in Turkey feel stuck, because they feel that they have nowhere to go but to Mr. Erdogan. And it's sort of like in the United States, that, you know, a lot of people are saying, well, you know, Harris is bad, but we don't want Trump. And maybe Harris, she said this word here, and when she comes to power, maybe she'll do something about Palestine. Or those who support Trump will say, well, you know, so he says all this nonsense, but maybe he's bombastic here because he wants to do this and do something different. They're all trying to find ways to justify where they stand. Or maybe not just justify, maybe they feel they have no option. I should be careful about Turkey, and there are people who know the country much, 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 much better than me. But in general, with regards to these Arab regimes, it's pretty clear that I think that what I said was accurate.
I think what you've mentioned is so important, the way that even Saudi Arabia is just going to the direction of Russia and China with BRICS, and the way that between Turkey and Erdogan and Bashar al-Assad in Syria, they were trying to make some sort of connection after those years of just animosity. And but at the end of the day, when you look at the Middle East, they're trying to understand, it seems to me that they're understanding what's going on, the bigger picture of the world. And let's remember that Saudi Arabia, UAE, they're trying to be closer to the United States because they feel that the United States right now is the sole superpower, because before that, before BRICS, before. But right now they're feeling how the world is changing. And specifically after this conflict in Ukraine, the changes are huge right now. And the United States, on the other hand, should understand what's going on in the Middle East, because at the end of the day, they want to have some sort of relationship, in my opinion, with Iran, with Turkey, with Saudi Arabia, which is so important for the future of the United States in order to make some sort of balance between the East and the West. But the policy in Israel doesn't seem to help them to make that picture, to make that balance. And the way that Iran and these governments in the Middle East are behaving, they have to make some sort of policies to make the United States understand what's going on. Do you see that's coming from the Middle Eastern countries in order to send some sort of message to the United States, not talking about right now, but in terms of the future?
You're absolutely correct. Although countries, these Arab despots, are bound to the West, but they do see what's happening. They do see the decline of the West. They do see that Ukraine, the ruble was supposed to be turned into rubble, and it didn't happen. and so on. And so they see Turkey's, their leaders, they all see what's happening. But some are bound to the West and they're having trouble to adjust. They're looking to Russia and China, but as I said, because of their relationship, deep relationship with the West, they can't escape. But this will happen inevitably. As the empire declines further, they're going to lose hold of many. One of the reasons why Erdogan he's spoken of rapprochement with President Assad, but the Americans are putting pressure on him not to, because the Americans want to keep Syrian forces focus on the north rather than focusing on Israel. So he's under pressure. But the United States is declining. There's no doubt about that. We all know it. I know that you've discussed this many times with other people who know much better than I, so I won't try to pretend that I know that I would be saying anything new. But the United States is declining. It needs better relations. It needs, evolve its foreign policy and improve its relations, or establish a new type of relationship with countries in the region. That would be the smart thing to do. And that is why I always say that the Israeli regime is not an asset to the United States. It is not an asset to the West. Maybe once upon a time during the Cold War, it was, which I think is still debatable, because creating anger and animosity across so many different countries is, you know, not a good thing. But now it's clear that it's detrimental to the West. The world is looking in disgust, and the region in particular. So Israel is a liability. Its existence today is detrimental. And it is what prevents what I think you were alluding to this rethinking of their foreign policy. If the United States was smart, it would be networking, creating a new type of relationship so that countries that are on the rise in the global South will not be able to draw so many different countries in our region towards themselves. The United States would want to be able to have very good relationships with different countries, but its behavior in Palestine and now in Lebanon is making it, I think, impossible. And I think the word is not pretty, but it benefits countries like Russia and China and those who are rivals or see themselves as rivals to the United States, because they are not a part of this genocide. They're not a part of this these atrocities. And so people look at them more fit. I mean, for example, I mean, this is not directly related, but the Israelis have used electronic goods as weapons. That hurts Western brands. That hurts all Western brands are hurt because, you know, brand America, brand EU is hurt. These entities are hurt, their brands are hurt. But when it weaponizes electronic devices, then it makes Chinese devices look more safe. And so people will increasingly go to their devices for safety, not just because the Americans are listening to what you do and weaponizing them in one way, but because they are literally, they've been turned into bombs and no one is being punished for it. If these explosions happened anywhere else in the world, you'd have a global crisis. You'd have the UN Security Council and you'd have NATO and everyone getting involved, and you'd probably see some country being bombed as a result. But because it's Israel, the West is willing to sacrifice its image, its credibility, its brands. And I certainly won't be purchasing any more electronic goods that are made by countries affiliated to the West as a result. So the point is that Israel, its existence today as an apartheid regime, as a supremacist regime, is hurting the West. It's a liability. And therefore, it prevents the West from doing exactly what you say it needs to do. The West didn't need this so much 20, 30 years ago. The US was that, someone once called it a hyperpower. They were the power. They controlled, you know, almost everything. China and Russia were weak at that time. Iran was isolated. But now the world is completely different. And so what you say is absolutely necessary for the West, but they are unable to make those changes because of these policies.
Yeah. Just to wrap up this session, Professor, we have a comprehensive new agreement between Iran and Russia, which would be, I don't know, in Kazan, they would sign it. And how, what do we know about the importance of this agreement between Iran and Russia?
I don't know the details, but it must be pretty important since it's being talked about a lot in Iran and Russia. But I what I would say is that this is very much linked to your previous question, because this is another side of the same problem, the same issue. When the West is unable to redefine its relationships, and even worse, when the West shows hostility to much of the rest of the world and shows its aggressive behavior, like in Palestine and Lebanon, by supporting the Israelis, it pushes countries towards its rivals. So the West has pushed Russia to Iran, closer to Iran, and pushed Iran closer to Russia, and pushed both closer to China and China to them. And the same is true with India in a different way. The same is true with different countries across the global South. The West sanctions more. The West threatens more. The West carries out these genocidal policies in Palestine. This is only going to make BRICS more popular. BRICS is not going to change the world after Kazan. This is not something that's not a flip of a switch and then suddenly you're going to have a, I don't know, new means for trade and business. But this is, this trend is intensifying. And Kazan will be an important post or an important moment in this transition. And the Iranian and the document that will be signed between Iran and Russia will also be a significant event and particularly when we look at it within this context. So the West is pushing countries away from itself, as you were basically saying in your previous question, and the West is pushing countries closer to each other in a different camp where the West is excluded by these very, as a result of these very same policies. Is this smart? Of course not. It's, and I think many sane people in the West know this, but those people at the top, I think some of them may know this privately, because sometimes when I do speak to people in private, they're very different from what they say on television and in the media. But I think many of them do live in that bubble. That, you know, they still think that we're the superpower. We're exceptional. We're different from everyone else. All we have to do is just try harder. Maybe bomb a few more countries. Maybe impose a few more sanctions. They're about to fall. The regime is going to fall. You know, like Iran or whatever. They're about to fall. They're about to crumble. It's imploding. But they're not looking at events based on reality. They're looking at events based on their hopes and aspirations. And that makes their analysis completely flawed. And as a result, they continue policies or bring about new policies that only make things worse.
I think the era of overthrowing governments, specifically in the Middle East, is gone, because if you remember during Bashar al-Assad, Assad is still in power. Most of those people who were talking about Assad are gone right now. And they have to understand, it's a big lesson for the audience, for whoever watches what's going on in the Middle East.
And even when they did succeed, like in Libya, we saw he died. What was the What was the consequence? What were the consequences? You had a huge influx of refugees going through Libya, North Africa, into Europe. They no longer are able to manage the situation. They cannot, not only do they fail, as you rightly point out, in their policies of overthrowing governments, but when they do, they only make things worse for themselves. They are not the power that they think they are. They're not the power that they used to be. And therefore, the same thing to do would be to rethink everything. But at least for the time being, I don't see that happening at all.
Yeah. Thank you so much for being with us today. Great pleasure to talk with you, Professor Marandi.
Thank you very much for having me.
My pleasure.